Welcome to Take Note. For WPSU from my home studio, I'm Lindsay Whistle Fenton. Joyelle Mulheron is a Washington, D.C. policy veteran who spent more than 15 years working for various governors, the White House, and a number of leading nonprofits. But her life changed forever following the death of her daughter, Eleonora, in 2010. Joyelle is now the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Evermore, where she works to make the world a more livable place for bereaved families through research, policy, and education. Her work has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and USA Today. She's also featured in WPSU's Speaking Grief Initiative. Casey Affleck won an Academy Award for playing a grieving father in Manchester by the Sea and has explored the grief experience in other roles like A Ghost Story and his upcoming film The World to Come. He uses his celebrity to bring awareness to the plight of grieving families. Joyelle and Casey, welcome to Take Note.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Joyelle, you refer to the implications of bereavement as an invisible public health crisis that touches nearly every American household, and it has unfortunately touched your household as well. This is something you are all too familiar with. We're going to talk more about the issues around bereavement more broadly, but first, tell us a little bit about your daughter, Eleonora.
Thank you for asking about her. Eleonora is our third child. We have four kiddos. And I learned when I was pregnant that there was something not quite right about this particular pregnancy, and learned very quickly I was likely to have a very seriously ill child. So I put together a medical team that I thought could provide the best care for our child, and was so delighted when she survived, not just the pregnancy, but then the delivery and the first few minutes and the first few hours. Kiddos with her condition often do not. And it was really during that experience and during the pregnancy that I realized where I went from sort of being the patient and following what the doctors were suggesting that I do to realizing that I am the only one who's going to be able to fight for her, like no one else. We decided to provide care for her at home. And it was a very obviously emotionally difficult experience, not just for myself, but for the whole family. And the whole time thinking this has been just such a terrible experience, and not just to watch your child die slowly and sometimes multiple times a day, but all the other things that were happening to us as a result.
And you're open about this, and that in the space of grief and in the instance with Eleonora, we're talking about so many different griefs, you know, the grief of her illness and then the grief of her death. And in this space, every interaction has the potential to be so healing or conversely so hurtful. And unfortunately, it seems like many interactions tend towards the latter. And in particular, I'm thinking of your experience that you've had so many of, but one example that just really has always stuck with me is the experience of your interactions with the insurance company around discussing Eleonora's care. So can you tell us about that?
When you have a very sick kid, health insurance companies give you a caseworker, and they would call, my caseworker would call, and she would say, well, honey, do you think she's going to die in 10 days or less than 10 days? Because if it's less than 10 days, I have to fill out different paperwork. And if it's more than 10 days, it's like 100 pages that I have to fill out. So do you think she's going to die really soon? And so, you know, just to receive those calls in the moment while you have a child who maybe that morning has had three events and almost died on the kitchen floor. And to just sort of always putting this in context, you know, you have the family and you have to mow the lawn and you have to do all of these other things. You're absolutely right. You have these moments of interactions with people where you're seeking just some compassion or some understanding, particularly from a company who sees the medical records, who understands the complexities of what's happening on a day-to-day basis, that there might be another way of getting that information, like calling another provider and maybe not the family themselves to ask, is she going to die and how soon?
And unfortunately, Eleonora did pass after 5 months in 2010. And you've said that every minute with her was full of hope and of life. What were those first months, years like for you after your daughter died? Like, walk us through a typical day, if that was even a thing in the space of being a bereaved parent.
It's hard to do. I will say in the first few weeks, it was impossible for me to know if I had showered, if I had eaten. My whole goal in the very beginning was to not lose my other children. I had two other elementary school girls. And so I just had to remember to get them from school. If we went to the grocery store, that I didn't forget that they were with me. Like, that was the only thing that I had the capacity to do. I actually, so many people, so a kind neighbor had created a flyer and told hundreds of people in our neighborhood that our daughter had died. And that was well-intentioned, but of course I wasn't looking to publicize this at this point. And so people were just streaming to our house with tons of food. And the irony is, at least for us, you're not hungry. You're so devastated. Like, you're not going to eat a casserole. And so all of these people were coming into the house. And so I left and stayed at a place down the street because I just couldn't handle all of the social interactions. It was too overwhelming. And it was November, and I found myself sitting outside in a tank top and shorts for several hours, and it was incredibly cold. But I've been with other families when this has happened. You don't even realize how cold you are and you're outside, and I was sunburned, and you're just numb. And that lasted for a while. I did end up going back to work, and I cried every day to and from work for about 18 months. And it was, it's something that no one should have to go through. It's very painful.
And unfortunately, far too many people do have to go through that. And, you know, Joyelle, from working with you on the Speaking Grief Initiative, I've learned that your experience is much more the rule than the exception when it comes to grief. But often, until we experience grief firsthand, much, if not all, of our understanding tends to come from the media we consume. If it's books, TV shows, movies. And that brings me to Casey. In your work, you received an Oscar for your performance in Manchester by the Sea, in which you play a bereaved father and brother. What did the preparation and an experience of embodying that role teach you about the reality of grief?
I can't take too much credit for that. It was this sort of insightful and empathic writing of Kenny Lonergan in Manchester by the Sea that really taught me the most, and that made that movie something that connected with people so deeply. It was a great roadmap for me. It wasn't fun to travel, but the thing about sort of working in the arts, or in particular being an actor and working with stories like that, is that you kind of get to go to work every day and bring all of your emotional baggage to work and dump it on the floor and hold it up for people to see. And it's very cathartic, and I'm lucky because most people have to go to work and keep all of that contained and buried down and do their job. So it's a unique position, and it's one of the things that I like about working in the arts.
And again, Manchester by the Sea offers a fictional glimpse at the experience of parents using a child, but this experience is a real one that comes with a lot of challenges and so many ways that we might not even be aware of. Joyelle, what kinds of implications are there for grieving people, particularly, let's say, for example, parents who experience the death of a child?
There are many, unfortunately, and mostly we look at this issue as a personal issue. And so we say, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss, and we kind of pull back and we don't know what else to say. And then as we observe the family from afar, we begin over the next couple of years to see, oh, they got sick from this, or their child's now having difficulties in school or interactions with law enforcement and so forth. And I think what's very unique here and unique about the work that we're doing is we're no longer looking at it from just a person-to-person tragedy. When I step back to look at the data around bereavement and the implications of losing a loved one, I find it stunning and incredibly worrisome, because it is not just the family themselves now that is at risk of poor health, social, or economic outcomes, but there are also pulls on our social systems, incarceration rates, drug abuse, violent crime involvement, lesser academic attainment, fewer wages. Those in the collective at the population level are some of the outcomes. And as a society, it's not simply knowing how to address your neighbor or your colleague or your friend who's lost someone so dear to them. But as a society, it's shifting the paradigm so that we're able to put a system of support around them so that we don't have so many negative outcomes for these individuals or our communities.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. Our guests are Joelle Mulheron, the founder and executive director of Evermore, a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of bereaved families, and Academy Award-winning actor Casey Affleck, who lends his celebrity to this work as an advocate for Evermore. Joelle is also featured in WPSU's Speaking Grief Initiative.
The U.S. does trail other developed nations when it comes to bereavement care, but you are working to change that with Evermore, which you founded in 2015. So when did that idea first begin percolating that this is an issue we need to take on and that you decided to found Evermore?
Truthfully, it was when I was on my kitchen floor one day, and it was literally the fifth time that day that our daughter almost died. And the phone is ringing, the school is calling, the employer wants me to resign because I'm taking up the FTE. Like, it was so much happening in that moment. I decided to go back to work because, frankly, I needed to. I would have spiraled terrifically and quickly had I stayed home. And I went back to work, and there were a series of high-profile events that began happening. And it was Trayvon, it was Hydea Pendleton and the Hotshot Firefighters and Sandy Hook and the Joplin Tornadoes and the Washington Mudslide. There were just a series of high-profile events. And I began to think, oh my goodness, all of these people are about to have similar experiences. They will lose their loved ones in different ways and interact with different systems, but they are about to be told, go find a therapist or a support group, and there you have it. And you may or may not have your job at the end of this. And that's when I decided I need to quit my career and the stability and the predictability and begin to look into this. So what started as sort of an intuition has certainly evolved to a sense of conviction that there's something here. And quite frankly, I feel a profound sense of responsibility now to move this issue forward, because I have been so humbled and honored to sit on the other side of family tables or stay in their homes over the weekends. And they have shared with me so many things that happened to them that they've never talked about to other people. And frankly, they never even realized either what was happening in the moment was wrong or what was happening in the aftermath was all related. And I feel that it's my obligation to begin moving this forward as a national issue and a national health priority.
What does Evermore do?
We are setting a national platform for public policy change around bereavement care.
What does that entail?
Really launching a social movement at the community level and working in Washington, D.C. and in other loci of power to change how the country sees and views bereavement.
Casey, what drew you to lending your voice and to getting involved in this work of advocating for bereaved families?
Well, Joelle inspired me to be involved in Evermore to the extent that I am. You know, it's been a disorienting and scary and difficult year. And I've had other years that are just as bad, but those were kind of just about my life. Whereas this year it was happening to everybody. And I was at home feeling like I wanted to do more. So everything that came my way, I said, yes, what can I do? What, you know, any opportunity to be involved in sort of easing the general suffering out there, I wanted to, and even in the sort of teeny ways that I could. And Evermore was a great one because it addresses a fundamental change that I was hoping to see happen, which is just people investing in one another, investing in compassionate support and making that a part of the agenda of our society, not just, you know, looking for ways to improve the GDP, making mental health care a priority. And, you know, there's no issue that exists in a vacuum, like Joelle was saying. I mean, bereavement is related to unemployment. It's related to mental health care. It's related to criminal justice.
The National Academy of Sciences says that the death of a child is the most stressful event a person can experience. Yet the death of a child is not covered by basic protections like the Family and Medical Leave Act, which begs the question, what kind of policies do exist currently that support and protect bereaved families in the U.S.?
So it depends where you look. There are not a terrific amount of them. And certainly around employer leave, bereavement leave, that is a place where a lot of work needs to be done. And frankly, this year, we'll be focused on doing that, both at the community level and at the national level.
What might the drawbacks be to some sort of national bereavement policy? For example, extending FMLA protection, having impacts on small businesses. I imagine that could be expensive or difficult for businesses. So what are we looking at in terms of maybe the flip side of if some sort of policy change happens?
So a policy is not uniform. So what would apply in an FMLA for a large employer may not necessarily apply for a mid-size or a small employer. You're absolutely right. In fact, the majority of employers in the United States are small employers, and it is just as critical that they continue to function. That being said, I do think that firing someone the day after or even the hours after their children have been murdered is not the way forward. And so I do think that there is not over-regulation by any stretch of the imagination, but there is a way to preserve an individual, preserve a job for at least a short term in order to just not add to the complicated nature of sort of getting your sea legs back underneath you and trying to get back out into the community.
We just had an election that demonstrated how deeply divided our country is when it comes to political ideology, among other things. But death is something that does not discriminate. Is bipartisan action possible for this issue?
Oh, undoubtedly. It's already happening. I've had the good graces of meeting with staffers in both the House and the Senate, both in the Democratic and the Republican parties. Everyone has been nothing but kind and generous and gracious. And to prove the point, the House Democrats put bereavement care in the U.S. appropriations budget. So for the first time, making it a national health priority. The Senate Republicans did the same and, in fact, added some extra bells and whistles to it. And so there's a perfect example of bipartisanship. And so I agree that when it plays out on the media, it may play in one direction, but when you sit down with people at the kitchen table, this is a shared human experience. And I believe no matter what side of the aisle you sit on, that there is a lot of hope on both sides, and there's a lot of belief on both sides that we can do better.
President-elect Joe Biden is no stranger to grief. He lost a wife and two children and has spoken very publicly about his grief experience, including at his speech at the 2020 Democratic Convention. How optimistic are you that having someone who's very open about grief in the White House will translate into meaningful change in terms of bereavement policy?
It would be impossible for me to speculate on that. I will tell you that certainly grief and bereavement are part of Joe Biden's experience, but it is a part of so many Americans' experience and so many former U.S. presidents. And that didn't necessarily parlay always into some advancement. So there have been great advancements by U.S. presidents who, to my knowledge, did not suffer significant or traumatic death events. And they led to airline safety measures. So I can't draw, you know, I can't look into the future and speculate exactly what Joe Biden will or will not do. But certainly I think he understands the complexities that families face. And I think he'll certainly have a greater fluency to understand what a lot of American families experience every day.
We can't talk about bereavement policy in the U.S. right now without acknowledging the massive implications of COVID-19 that we're seeing and that are going to continue to unfold for many years to come. How has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted Evermore's work?
I certainly think it's brought the need to the forefront. And I think it, you know, unfortunate as it is, I think this might be one of the reasons why Congress is listening. I will say I started my conversations prior to COVID-19 in January with both the House and Senate because we already had epidemics of suicide, homicide, and overdose. So they were already listening, and now COVID-19 is here, and it only punctuates the importance and the urgency that we start addressing this as a societal issue.
Casey, you're lending your voice to Evermore as an advocate, but I also want to acknowledge the other important way you're advancing how we come to bereavement in this country, and that is through your work as a filmmaker and as an actor and an artist. As we touched on before, so much of our societal understanding of grief comes from how we see it portrayed in the media, which is often really out of step with the reality that many grieving people face. But the roles you take on offer so much more nuance and realism in their portrayals of grief. What role can media play in raising awareness?
I think that, you know, storytellers in a society have a significant impact on how people think about all things. And having an audience of any kind is a privilege and is a responsibility too. And I didn't always think of myself in that way as an actor or writer or director. You know, I spent a lot of years just doing whatever job I could get and lending myself to whatever story someone else was telling. But, you know, even actors grow up eventually. And I've of late put more thought into the kinds of stories that I tell and what they are saying and what I'm a part of. And the more of that in general there is, and the more aware we are and sensitive about that, how we depict people, who we depict, what we're leaving our audiences with, I think that the better off that we'll be. And not, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but all through time, storytellers have played a role in making their societies better places.
And you have a new film coming out that also has aspects of grief in that. What can you tell us about the world to come?
Ron Hansen and Jim Shepherd, they're both professors and they're both novelists, and they wrote a story about two women on a farm in the 19th century. And one of these women has lost a baby and finds it impossible to reconnect with her husband, impossible to feel anything until she meets somebody new, someone who moves in on the farm, next farm over, and it's played by Vanessa Kirby. And they have a relationship that surprises both of them, that is one that's sort of comforting, that turns romantic. And I'll leave it at that. But I think that Jim and Ron did such a, and also sort of the two actors, Vanessa and Catherine, they just, you know, they really put all of themselves into this. And it explored an aspect of grief that I hadn't considered, which is sort of in a, what happens to the couple, how difficult it is for this couple to reconnect, reinvest in their relationship, to maybe try to move on and have another kid if possible. It's very moving. It's based on a short story that Jim Shepherd wrote by the same title.
That's something we can look forward to. And Lord knows we need things to look forward to in 2021. Casey, you and I are similar in that we both have sort of come to the space of grief and bereavement and raising awareness, not having been necessarily prompted by a specific grief experience of our own. Yet I think a lot of people assume that personal loss is the only reason anyone would want to get involved in this work. So what would you say to others listening who feel like outsiders in this space, or who aren't sure if they have a place or a role in this work around grief and supporting bereaved families?
Well, I don't think that there's any experience that is more universal. You're going to know someone. You're going to lose somebody. I remember when I was a teenager, we lost someone in our family, and my mother's boyfriend said to me something that may sound sort of obvious to adults, but to a 13-year-old, was a different way of thinking of things. He said, death is a part of the human experience. And the reason that at the time meant so much was because we tend to not talk about death. I think we're afraid of it in our culture. So it feels like something almost shameful. And when it happens, it's difficult to deal with. And it's difficult to support one another because we don't really have, I don't know how to talk about it. We don't have the tools. We're sort of stumbling through it a little bit, and that's okay. But it's nice to have the guidance of others who have thought a lot about this and have gone through this to sort of help tell us how we could maybe support one another in better ways. And I have lost people. There are people who have, I think, had a harder time with it and experiences that were more challenging than I have so far. But we all have a stake in this, and that ought to be obvious. It's ask not for whom the bell tolls when thinking about bereavement. It tolls for you.
And you mentioned the importance of having guidance as we work to get better at this. So, Joyal, what can people do if they want to support bereaved families?
So if you want to support bereaved families, the first thing I would say is say something. Say I'm sorry, or just be present. And to listen. And one of the things that I often suggest to people is, in a time of such unpredictability for a family, to the extent that you can support someone else in a predictable fashion. So if every Tuesday at 4:00, you go over with an ice cream cone and you're just there to listen, even if they don't welcome you in on one Tuesday, they might the next or the next. And I will assure you that many, many individuals feel so profoundly alone. So just knowing that there's someone else who cares and that remembers and who's willing to show up is so valuable and important. So, to Casey's point and all the other things that we've said here, it's just an act of human compassion and being willing to sit with your neighbor or your friend or your family and just listen and to be present.
Joyal and Casey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Joyal Mulheron is the founder and executive director of Evermore, a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of bereaved families. She's also featured in WPSU's Speaking Grief Initiative. Academy Award-winning actor Casey Affleck lends his celebrity to Evermore's work as an advocate. To watch the 2020 Evermore Digital Summit, which features Casey Affleck, visit wpsu.org/take note. In the weeks since this interview was recorded, bereavement care was included in the federal budget for the first time ever. From my home studio, I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton, WPSU.